Well, turn with me this morning in your Bibles to Romans chapter 1. I'm going to be talking about that in just a minute. I want you to already be there when we get there. But if you haven't been with us over the last few weeks, I've begun a new series on systematic theology. And this morning's message is the third message in that series. I'm not going to do any kind of review this morning, but we are still on the subject of theology proper, which pertains to the doctrine of God. In the first two parts of this series, we examined a few of the more common arguments for the existence of God. And these arguments stem primarily from what Paul writes in Romans chapter 1, verses 18 through 21. And there you'll recall him saying, "The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. For even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened." And again, we built a very strong case, I believe, establishing and marking out the folly of those who call themselves atheists. If you want to look at it from a scriptural standpoint, which we should, atheism is an impossibility. Why? Because God himself says that it's an impossibility. He has made what needs to be known about his existence. Now, understand again, we're not talking about a salvific knowledge or a saving knowledge, but he has made known whatever man needs to know about him in terms of his existence. And that's patently clear, and you can use those arguments accordingly to make that case. If you missed either of the messages covering those things, I would encourage you to go to sermon audio and listen to those when you're able. Now, this morning, we're still looking at the doctrine of God, but now we come to the point where we, you know, having established this indisputable fact of God's existence, now we need to begin looking at his attributes, or as the Puritans preferred, his perfections. His perfections. And I do think that's an important distinction to make. I do think that the word perfections is a much better word to describe what we're talking about than attributes. And I've shared with you why that is. Attributes, by and large, are considered those things that we attribute to someone or something. Perfections, on the other hand, are those things which are inherent in the someone or something that we're talking about. So in God's case, we don't attribute anything to him. God is. This is why he said to Moses, when Moses asked, "Who shall I say sent me?" God says, "Tell them that I am sent you." In other words, God establishes there an indisputable fact, and that is the fact that he simply is. And so everything about God simply is. And we'll talk more about that as we go through this. Just to kind of wet your whistle a little bit, God is holy, not because we think he's holy, not because we ascribe holiness to him. God is holy because why? Because he's holy. God's righteous because he is righteous. God is sovereign because he is sovereign. This is especially important, I think, when it comes to things like the lordship debate. Why this is a debate among those who profess Christ, I'll never know. But there are some who believe that Jesus Christ is not Lord until you deem him to be Lord. Jesus Christ is not Lord until you designate him the Lord of your life. And we know better. In keeping with what we understand about the perfections of God, Jesus Christ being God is Lord because he's Lord. Amen. Doesn't matter whether you believe it, doesn't matter whether you agree with it or not. He is Lord. And we're told that there's coming a day when every knee will bow and every tongue confess, that's the regenerate and the unregenerate, every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. There won't be any debate then, which should cancel the debate that's going on now, but it doesn't. People still insist that he's Lord because we choose to make him so. So the word perfections is much more suitable when we're talking about a thrice holy triune Godhead. The Godhead is perfect in every way. There can be nothing added to it. There can be nothing taken away from the triune Godhead. And that is why it's a perfect arrangement. Now, where do we begin? Well, we begin talking about God's perfections by understanding that God's perfections can be categorized in one of two ways. God has both communicable perfections. We call those attributes, and rightly so, because anything we share with God, we do not demonstrate perfectly. And so that's where the word attributes actually comes in. God has communicable attributes, and he has incommunicable perfections. And don't let the big words scare you again. When we talk about communicable and incommunicable, well, when we talk about communicable attributes, we're talking about things that prove that we are the Imago Dei, that we're made in the image of God. God has shared with us certain characteristics inherent to himself, and we exhibit those attributes, as imperfectly as we might do that, because we're made in his image. Now, what are some of the communicable attributes? There's things like spirit. God is spirit. We have a spiritual component. Why? Because we're made in the image of God. Things like intellect. The reason we have an intellect is because God is omniscient. God knows everything, and he has shared with us in a communicable way knowledge and the ability to think rationally about things. Wisdom is another one of those communicable attributes. We do have some modicum of wisdom. Morality. God is a moral being, and so we, created in the image of God, have a sense of morality. Things like love, grace, mercy, justice, volition, or a will, not a free will. We've just come through the 502nd anniversary of Martin Luther's nailing of the 95 Theses on the door of the Wittenberg Church, and part of Martin Luther's diatribe against the Pope and against anyone who would disagree is the fact that man's will is bound in sin. It's not free at all. He's not free to do as he will. He is free to do anything and everything, but only in accordance with his sin nature. Right? And I'm not here to talk about that this morning, but that's why when we say that we have a volition, we need to understand that we don't have a volition like God's. We have a fallen volition that's inclined to do only that which our fallen flesh dictates needs to be done. As his creatures, again, we possess these things as proof that we have his fingerprints, as it were, on us. Now, because of sin, as I said a minute ago, what are his perfections are our attributes. Does that make sense? I hope that does, because we're not perfect. And the moment you think you are perfect, even in thinking you're perfect, you've proved yourself to be imperfect, because that's a sin, right? Now, what about his incommunicable perfections? What are those? Well, we're going to be looking at those over the next several months. This is going to take a long time. If you're wondering, hey, Pastor Tim, what are you going to do after you finish your systematic theology? I don't know that I'll ever finish. And I mean that honestly. Because especially the topic of theology proper, when we're talking about God the Father, how much could we say about God the Father over time? We could spend the rest of our lives talking about God the Father. So that's another thing too. Don't come to me periodically and say, oh, but you missed this and you missed that. I'm going to miss a lot. But I'm just hitting the high points as we go through this. And even that's going to take a considerable amount of time. So, where do we begin when we begin to consider God's perfections? I think the perfect place to begin is with his self-existence. And you can't talk about God's self-existence without also talking about his self-sufficiency. Self-existence and self-sufficiency. How many of you have ever wondered, where did God come from? Right? I mean, this is probably one of the more difficult well, it's actually one of the impossible questions that we can ask. We can't answer that question except to say that God always is. Not was, because that denotes past tense. God always is. God is eternal. That's one of his incommunicable attributes. God is infinite. No beginning, no end. In other words, there was never a time when God did not exist. Now, why is this important? Why should the question of God's existence be understood before any further question can be asked about him? It's important because God's self-existence, and if you want a single word for his self-existence and his self-sufficiency, it's the word aseity. A-S-E-I-T-Y. Aseity. Again, theologians like to make up, million-dollar words that nobody knows the meaning of, just so they can communicate with each other, because there's so much bound up in that single term. His aseity, and every time I say the word aseity, you're to be thinking self-sufficiency and self-existence. His aseity is what establishes him as utterly unique among everything in the created realm. He is utterly unique. The doctrine of God's aseity is what separates him from what he has created. There's God, who is infinite, eternal, self-existing, self-sufficient, and there's everything else. As the self-existing God, he transcends everything in the created realm because, number one, he created it all. And two, because he's uniquely other than all of that which he has created. He's uniquely other. The doctrine of God's aseity, or his self-existence and self-sufficiency, is necessary because it establishes the fact that God had no beginning, period. God had no beginning, period. Not even in himself. Now I'm going to need to have you put your thinking caps on. Tighten your, I would say pew belts, but we're not in pews. Tighten your seat belt, as it were, because some of the things we're about to cover are going to be a little bit heady. Not difficult, but they will cause you to ponder everything you've ever thought you believed about God. We have so much harmful programming because of religion in this world that even the most studied Christian often has to decompress or remove a lot of the baggage that he or she carries with them because of bad teaching. And this is one of those cases in point. Think about this. When we talk about God's aseity, his self-existence, God never created himself. Why? Because he would have to exist before himself to create himself. God owes his being to no one or nothing else, because if he's the product or byproduct of another's creation, then he himself is beholden to whoever or whatever created him. That can't be. Now, I know this sounds confusing, and that's understandable because, again, we're approaching it with our limited, finite human minds. But as difficult as it is to understand, it's critical that we do our best to do so. Why? Because this doctrine forms the basis for why we believe, and we must believe, that God is neither like us. Now, understand this. He's neither like us, nor is he affected in any way by what we think, say, or do. There are many, and sadly a great number of these individuals profess to be Christians, who have been taught that we have the ability to change God. And some of you might be thinking, nah, I don't know if I was ever told that. Yes, you were. Yes, you were. Because by and large, this is how human beings think about God. we have actually cluttered up the simplicity of God through His Word with all kinds of erroneous understandings about who we think God is. And one of those erroneous understandings is this idea that we can somehow change God. Many, for example, believe that prayer changes God's mind. Others believe that, you know, man's Godward exercise of his alleged free will is the catalyst for God's granting salvation. In other words, and I've even heard this from numerous pulpits over the years, there's a very common belief among those professing Christ today that God cannot save an individual until that individual gives him permission to do so. That's not only utterly preposterous, and I know this comes from the mouths of well-meaning people, but that's blasphemy. This is why the doctrine of salvation, soteriology, is so critically important. It's important that we get it right, because there's an entire school out there who believes that we're able to manipulate God by our own decisions. And they'll say things like, yeah, your salvation happened because God in eternity past looked down the corridors of time. He saw you choose Him. And on the basis of what you did, He wrote your name in the Lamb's Book of Life. You don't have that power. I don't have that power. No man has that power. Why? Because God Himself not only will not yield or cede that power to anyone else, He cannot. You understand that? Oh, but Pastor, you just said God cannot do something. That's right. God cannot betray His aseity, His perfections. Some, and I would say this no doubt applies to some here this morning, feel as though God benefits in some way or is blessed in some way by our worship of Him. How many times have you heard that? God is blessed by your worship. God is blessed by your giving. God is blessed by... You want to know the truth of the matter? God is not affected in any way, period, by anything you and I say, think, or do. Now, how do we know that, though? We know that because if we have the power to affect Him in any way, then we are able to affect change in Him. Whether that's going from sad to happy, happy to sad, glad to mad, whatever the case might be, mad to glad, if we suppose that we have the ability to change Him in that way, then He is in fact not immutable. He can be manipulated. He can be changed. And I know this might come as a surprise for some of you, but as Isaiah said, even our best attempts at righteousness are as filthy rags before a thrice holy God. God is not in any way affected by anything that we do. And not only would that be a violation of His immutability, but more importantly, it's a violation of His complete and utter self-sufficiency. Now, I want you to think about that for just a minute. To suggest that God needs man or benefits from man in any way is to make Him, at least to some degree, dependent on man for the things He receives from us. How many of you will admit that you've never really given this that much thought? I'll be honest with you, prior to this past week, I'd never given this a great deal of thought. It's pleasing to our minds and our hearts to think that God benefits from us in some way. It's pleasing to consider that we might just be helping God out. People say, you know, well, I go out and evangelize because, you know, then God is pleased with me. No. No. He's not changed in any way by what you do. So why evangelize? You evangelize for your sake, for the sake of the people that you're evangelizing, so that they too might come to know this thrice holy triune God that we worship. Now let me show you a couple of scriptures that speak to this. Look at Job 22. Job 22. Job 22 in verses 2 and 3. Job's friend, Eliphaz, challenges Job with a few rhetorical questions. And you all know what rhetorical means, right? It means the answer is generally no. Or nothing. It's in the negative, right? What does Eliphaz say? Can a man be profitable to God? Surely he who is wise is profitable to himself. Is it any pleasure to the Almighty if you are in the right? Or is it gain to him that you make your ways blameless? That's a good question. Of course, the answer is no. God doesn't benefit in any way because of your obedience, because of your righteousness. Your righteousness, which is Christ's righteousness imputed to you if you're a believer, your obedience is to serve as a confirmation to you that you're in a right relationship to God. It does nothing to God. Why? Again, go back to what we're talking about, the doctrine of God's self-sufficiency. He doesn't need you to be obedient so that he can be whole. He doesn't need you to be obedient so that he can be happy. He doesn't need you to be obedient so that he can be anything, because he is everything already. The thrust of these rhetorical questions is that God is not obligated to man because God can't receive anything from him in terms of anything that would make him worse or better. We've already established that God is perfect. So if there's anything, not just in our actions, our behaviors, our thoughts, our obedience, so on and so forth, if there's anything in the entire created realm that is able to add to him or take away from him, then he was never perfect to begin with. What is perfection? Perfection is a condition where nothing can be added or nothing can be taken away from you to make you better or worse. God is perfect. And so for us to give anything to God that would make him anything else than he already is would render him never being perfect to begin with. Look at Job 35. Now, since you're in Job. Job 35, verses 6 and 7. Job has another friend. Elihu. Let me just say this. You need friends like Eliphaz and Elihu. You do. Elihu asked him a similar question. He says, if you sin, what do you accomplish against him? Or if your transgressions are multiplied, what do you do to him? If you are righteous, what do you give him? Or what does he receive from your hand? What's the answer? Nothing. Now, why were Eliphaz and Elihu speaking to Job in this way? They were actually rebuking Job. Because if you'll recall, Job was a righteous man. Satan, making his trips from earth to heaven and back and forth, approaches God with what he thought was a bargain that might prove God to not be God after all, right? Satan says, look, there's this character Job. I can get the righteous to curse you before your face. What does God say? Have you tried my servant Job? You can do anything you want to him, just don't kill him. Right? And so Job was considered, even by God, to be a righteous man. Now, that doesn't mean Job was a perfect man. But God set him up as someone who was worthy of being tested in these ways. And to prove that Job's not perfect, even Job began to buckle under some of this pressure, at least to the point where Job said, "Look, I know I've behaved righteously, so God, you owe me an explanation for why you have done these things to me." You know, this is why in Job chapter 38, God speaks back to Job. Remember what he says? "Who is this who darkens counsel with words without knowledge? Gird up your loins and take it like a man." And then for another 173 verses or so, he just dresses Job down. "Where were you when I did this and did that and the other thing?" And, you know, and Job just goes, beep, beep, doop, 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 doop. Until finally Job repents and acknowledges that God is far greater than he even imagined. But Eliphaz and Elihu are dressing Job down because Job thought that God owed him a hearing, that God owed him an explanation. Eliphaz and Elihu correctly understood that God didn't owe Job anything at all. Why? The reason Job thought God owed him an explanation, the reason Job thought God owed him a hearing, was because Job assumed that he had caused God to react in the way that he assumed he had the power to influence. Right? Job's like, "I must have done something to cause God to be this way." Now look over at Job 41. In verse 11, God himself says nearly the same thing as Job's friends. And I want you to understand this. You need to really process this, because God himself says, "Who has preceded me that I should pay him? Everything under heaven is mine." Now, ponder that for just a minute. Everything under heaven belongs to God. Now, if it already belongs to God, and it does, what can Job, what can you, what can I ever give God that's not already his? Nothing. Nothing. James Dozal has written a book, nice little book, kind of a moderately difficult read if you're not familiar with a lot of theological terms and stuff, but the book is All That Is in God. I highly recommend the book to you. But let me read to you just a snippet of what he says with regard to this. He says, "When God gives to his creatures, he does not give away. That is, he does not divest himself of being an actuality when he gives good gifts to humans. Consequently, we have nothing to bestow in God that he does not already perfectly and infinitely possess in his fullness of being. As we cannot subtract from his infinite beatitude, neither can we replenish or enlarge it." Some of you, and no doubt many, if not the majority of those in churches all over the country this morning, you might feel as though you've come here to give God your worship. Have you ever heard that phrase? "We've come here to give God our worship," as if that's something he needs or that's something he benefits from. We often speak in terms of giving back to God a portion of that which he has so graciously given us. And I fully understand the sentiment behind that, so don't be paranoid. You know, if you're praying before the offering, that's perfectly acceptable in human terms to reflect on what God has given you and then to consider what we're doing as giving back to God. But here's the rub. You're not giving anything to him. It's his to begin with. You know, we can feel quite puffed up sometimes. We can feel very good about ourselves because of our level of piety, our level of holiness, our level of self-righteousness. We can come and worship God, and we can give of our tithes and our talents and time and all of this. And we can feel really good about ourselves as if we've done something substantive to make God feel a certain way about us. It's not true. Because again, to do anything, to give anything, including your worship, to give anything, to do anything for Him, does not change Him in the least, because it cannot change Him in the least. Look at Acts 17. I think Paul hits the nail on the head. Acts 17, you'll recall, he's speaking to the Athenians. Remember, they had this, not tomb, it was a memorial erected to the unknown God. And Paul walks through the city and he's saying, I perceive that you're a very religious people. Then he says, let me tell you about this God that you say is unknown. Let me make Him known a bit to you. And later on, there in verse 23, we're going to start 23b. He says this. He says, therefore, what you worship in ignorance, this I proclaim to you. The God who made the world and all things in it, since He is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands. You see, that's a statement about His immensity. Remember, even in the earliest days, when the tabernacle was erected in the wilderness, there were people of the mind that they could contain God. Even in the temple, as great and wonderful as that was, even Solomon said, look, there's no way that God would dwell in a temple made with human hands. But we're going to do it anyway because God is worthy. Right? So Paul says, He doesn't dwell in temples made with hands, nor is He served by human hands. As though He needed anything. Since He Himself gives to all people life and breath and all things. And He made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined their appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation, so that they would seek God, if perhaps they might grope for Him and find Him. Though He is not far from each one of us, for in Him we live and move and exist. And even some of your own poets have said, for we also are His children. The point Paul's making here, at least in part, is that when we serve God, He's not in any way enriched or repaid by our actions. Once again, Dozal says this. He says, God's glory is not actually increased when we glorify Him. You ever thought about that? His glory is not increased when we glorify Him. His perfect fullness of love is not intensified by our acts of obedience. His intrinsic infinite hatred for sin is not made a little hotter by our transgressions. All these things, being glorious, loving, opposed to sin, God simply is in and of Himself. John Owen also had a lot to say about this as well. I mean, face it, John Owen had a lot to say about a lot of things. Now, let me shorten that. John Owen had a lot to say. If you've never read the works of John Owen, I don't recommend that you do that, really, unless you like waterboarding. And no, he's a tough read. I mean, let's say this. If you have an attention span that will allow you to read a sentence that lasts 3 pages long, go for it. Oh, and not to mention, he frequently just blurts out long paragraphs in Latin. So if you want to sit there with your Latin dictionary and go through all that. No, I say that in jest. If you're able to read John Owen, read John Owen, because if you can weed through all the difficulty, you'll find some real gems in what he had to say. He said this about what we're talking about this morning. He says, God alone hath all being in Him. Hence He gives Himself the name I Am.
That's what we talked about from Exodus 3:14. He is eternally all. When all things else that were made or now are or shall be were nothing, in this state of infinite eternal being and goodness, before any act of wisdom or power outside of himself to give existence unto other things, God was and is eternally in himself, all that he will be, all that he can be unto eternity. For where there is infinite being and infinite goodness, there is infinite blessedness and happiness, whereunto nothing can be added. God is always the same. All things that are make no addition unto God. No change in his state. His blessedness, happiness, self-satisfaction, as well as his other infinite perfections, were absolutely the same before the creation of anything. This is the God that we have to wrap our brains around. This is the infinite God that we have to wrap our finite brains around. This is the unsearchable God that we must search out in order to understand not only more about him, but more about ourselves. This is the knowledge of God that we must latch onto if we're to understand just how deficient we are in our knowledge of God. It's on the basis of God's aseity, that is, he owes his existence to no one and he depends on no one at any time. It's this that serves as the foundation for his immutability, which we're going to talk about, Lord willing, next week. Some of you might be thinking, well, you just talked about God's immutability. No, not yet. We've just established the reason that God is unchangeable. God is unchangeable because he cannot change. Well, that's probably true in some ways, but no, God cannot change. Period. Now let me just throw out a few questions for discussion.